And I want to start in the book of James, the first chapter of the book of James. And then we'll kind of go drifting around a little bit. Excuse me. First five verses of chapter 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting. Now he gets into, my brethren, count it all joy. Now all joy is supreme joy. So if you were to go out of this King James language and you get into the meaning of the Greek and in some of the more modern Bibles, they interpret it that way, that you are to count something as supreme joy. Now what we're going to count as supreme joy is not normal. Because normally, if we're going to think about joy, we're going to think about something where we're at ease. There's something coming into us in some way that we really like. Or we're having a good relationship with somebody and this is going on. And joy, we have a very limited view of joy. Now, that was one of my words of the day, was the word joy. And the kids had as much trouble with joy trying to write sentences, and they have to write two sentences. First, they were just writing one. Now I have them up to two. And they are not able yet to think through what the word means, even though I give them the definition. I give them the word and the definition, and then I ask them to write two sentences. And so they write all that I gave them. They write that out. Then they have to do an application. So if we're going to apply something, we have to go a little deeper than just having some words on a page. And so the word joy, when I gave them the word joy, it was really, there was almost nothing said that related to joy. There was a little, you know, be like having a birthday party or something of that nature. But that's not the kind of joy he's talking about. And it's hard to understand this joy because it's a fruit of the Holy Spirit. It's not a fruit of natural things. It's a fruit of the Holy Spirit. So if you're counting it supreme joy and you say, how can I do this? When you fall into diverse temptations, says King James, when it says when you fall into different kinds of trial. Well, as I said now for the 9 millionth time, in the United States of America, the church has never been on trial. It's had moments where there were things, but never really on trial, because the church was basically the foundation of everything, and biblical law was in the rule as we started out in 1600 and we're coming up, and the churches were staffed by very sound and able preachers, and they were teaching primarily the law of God. And covering every area of life. What does God have to say about marriage? What does God have to say about child training? What does God have to say about business? And going down the line, everything they did was the application of some law of God. And then at some point, this began to be diluted until we got to the point that instead of having genuine preaching, we had what is called sermonizing. That's my word, sermonizing. And in sermonizing, what they tend to do, and some of these guys are good speakers, really good speakers, but when they sermonize, they will take a verse, and then they will present all this stuff that they present, which really doesn't even connect to the verse. But the people sitting there don't know that. I said on Wednesday night, I don't think that when people go to church, they really learn. There are exceptions, of course. That's not 100% true. But people go to church and they don't learn. And that's part of the reason why you have the circumstance in America you have now where you have the Antichrist assuming more and more and more power. And the Christians don't know how to come back against it. What do you do to fight against this thing? So your starting point is this thing of counting it all joy. And the reason is not because I am poor or rich. It's because I belong to Jesus Christ. And in my life, that is the function of my life, is to present Jesus Christ in whatever way that I present him, and the teaching I do to present Jesus Christ as King of Kings, as Lord of Lords, as the Redeemer, as the High Priest that sits at the right hand of the Father, as all those things we present Christ. So he says to them, when you come into all these different kinds of temptations, know this, that what's happening when this comes is that it is actually your patience that's on trial. Now, in the fruit of the Spirit, they have the word long-suffering. And long-suffering, if you go into the Greek, it's a pretty shallow word. In that it has one or two definitions. A lot of times you get in like Webster. If you go into Webster's 1828 and you look up a word, you might find a whole page of definitions, like he does with good. And if you look up joy in his dictionary, you'll find more things. But in this particular thing, where they translated joy, where they translated long suffering, it was just simply kind of saying put up with. That something is going on that you don't like, just put up with it. Well, we're never supposed to do that. We don't put up with. We are to always be in contention. So the in Jude, when he said that we are to earnestly contend for the faith, that doesn't mean when everything is good and you've got great freedom in order to present gospel tracts or to go out in the street corner and preach. Like, I don't know if you remember, the guy used to be downtown Warren all the time. They had all of the badges on him and everything, and his van had all kind of scripture things. And I asked him one day, I went over and I said, do you present Christ to people? He said, no, that's not my job. My job is just to do what he was doing. But he was doing it, and he did it all over the country. He didn't just do it here. So we had this time of freedom where the church, because it had freedom and did not have contention or competition, got lazy. Now, when you get lazy and things change, it's hard to adapt because you don't know how to adapt. So what he said here, he said that what's happening is your patience is being put on trial. And then he said, after that, if you lack wisdom, ask God. So in trying to evaluate, I get so frustrated with people who get all their information from Fox News or one of these big stars, these news stars, who go on there and rant and rave and carry on and but they don't ever accomplish anything. At least Rush, when he was on the air all the years he was on there, did accomplish something, so that now that he's been gone, people are still playing Rush, and they're still going back to say, what did he say about this? But a lot of these guys who are the big superstars in the so-called news area, they're very contentious. But they don't. I asked this question to somebody who was watching. Don't ask me to name the names because I don't know all the names. But this person was watching these people every day, faithfully, watching to hear the complaint. And so I asked them, I asked this question, when they are making their complaint, do they ever quote the scripture? And do they ever give you a biblical response? And the answer was no. And I said, well, what's the point? Now, I understand that God always has to have people to stir up. So at the time of the War for Independence, he had guys that were really stirrers, and they were, in the capacity they had, communicating the desire to get free of England, and that was building until finally they got to the point that the people were ready to go out and fight. So I understand they're called antagonists. And so you have an antagonist, and Satan can have antagonists, and God can have antagonists, but you still have to come back down to where are you going to get wisdom from? How are you going to know the information, and then how are you going to know what to do with the information? How long have we've been talking about the law in Deuteronomy with regard to child training, where he says to the parent, first of all, you, okay, I'll start with you. You get my law in your heart. You get there, and so that you know it and you practice it, and then you teach it to their children. So they're not only going to teach it verbally to their children, they're going to teach it by example. So the child, because this child is way down here and they're gradually growing, the child is going to copy something. Children are copycats. And whatever is the thing that is predominant, that's what they're going to copy, unless there is a counter. So in the United States, we surrendered the kids to the government school system. We got to the point, as I said Wednesday night about not learning, I said, why is it that God has given a specific qualifier that a person has to meet before they can be in public office, which he did in Exodus 18. Here are the qualifications. He said, why are Christians not, at least Christians, not examining these people on the basis of God's requirement to see whether or not they should even be running for office? Well, when you're ignorant, you don't do those things. When you have never learned that this is God's order, you get into this popularity contest. And so whoever is the most popular wins the election. That didn't happen this last time, but obviously Biden had some popularity in the communist world and in all of those things. So he is inaugurated president. But the church is supposed to know this. I told, I don't know who I was talking to, and I said, if I go into vote, I never vote for anybody on the ballot that I don't know about. So you have all these names in these offices, and I see people over there clicking, 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 and I say, I wonder what they know about qualification. If you lack wisdom, so if you lack wisdom, ask God. And so one of the things we ask God is how to determine qualification. Well, go read the book. It's in the book, all right? So if we ask God, so if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God, who gives to all, the word men is supplied, give liberally. So you're not going to have a problem if you're a child of God getting wisdom, because God gives freely, and he does not find fault. He upbraideth not. So God isn't sitting there trying to point his finger at every little thing you have wrong in your life. And everybody has things wrong in their life. And sometimes they're so tiny. It's like that window. That window's in there all these years and was never fastened. And so it was a blessing of the Lord that the wind didn't blow it out. Bob said, Dad, that thing wasn't fastened in there. I said, well, I didn't put it in. So I don't have an answer. And then he had the wisdom to, instead of one window, get two windows and build the whole thing in there so that when these windows went in, just as these up here, when they went in, they're actually in the way they're supposed to be in. And it takes more time. It takes time in this case of learning God's way, study, prayer, preparation, conversation, and recognizing one of the things that we need, I think we're weak in, but we need to recognize is that God has used men through the ages to write commentaries. This is what they did. Spurgeon, who I put on the front of the bulletin today, Spurgeon must have lived in his study. I don't see how he could have spent much time outside of it, because his writings are so prolific. And he had to spend a lot of time. I'm sure he did, because he was out praying for the sick and so forth. But we've had these guys through history. Not every commentator has merit, but some of them do. I was just rereading the book Heaven Opened. And it's by these two brothers. Their last name in their home country is Allen, but the spelling looks like Aileen. And that book, Heaven Opened, is all about God. And it's not a big book, but it's really small print. So it takes a little time to go through and read, but every chapter has something to do with God, in which they are exalting the Lord and praising the Lord and pointing out the problems of offending the Lord all through that book, and it's only about that thick. It's a simple little thing, all right? Well, God has put men in this position But as we went along, we quit listening to them. When I listened to R.C. Sproul, R.C. Sproul's another one. He must have spent forever in his office. And he says that his favorite commentator, if you want to use that, was Augustine. And I thought, Augustine? Who reads Augustine? I call him Augustine. Call him Augustine. I said, who reads Augustine? Well, Sproul does, and or did. And there must have been some others who are reading Augustine or Augustine, because they then connect him to Calvin. And they say, and Sproul would say, here's Augustine said this about this. And then a couple of seconds later, he'll quote Calvin. Well, if God has put these people in a position of teaching in the church through the ages, and the church is not ever going to them, they have their own teacher, but they go to these people also because you're trying to confirm everything. What is this particular view? What is this particular view? On my Bible program on the computer, I have several Bibles on there. In the New Testament, there's one that's called the Weymouth New Testament, and it was published in late 1800s. And it's in the English. It's not in the professional or whatever the word is for English. It's in the everyday language of the common man. And so if you take a verse from King James, even you take this verse, and then you go over to Weymouth and you look at what he has to say, and you go back and look, and then you say, well, let me go to the Greek and see if what Weymouth is saying is closer than what King James is saying. So many times you find it is, that he is more loyal to the Greek than King James was in this particular situation, not in all of them. But that means that what you're doing is you're seeking wisdom. So I use the Blue Letter Bible also. I use the ESORD, and I have all these Bibles on there, and I have a number of commentaries on there, and some dictionaries and some encyclopedias. And so I can go through, and if I have a word or I have something that's an idea, you can go through and see what you can find. Now, why are you doing that? Because you're seeking wisdom. Because when you're going to teach it, you don't want to teach haphazardly. You don't just want to go out and throw words out. You want to try to find out what meaning is there so that you can hopefully enlighten this person we call a student, so that the student can fulfill the prophecy made by God to Paul, from Paul to Timothy. That which I have taught you, I want you to learn, then I want you to teach faithful men who in turn will be able to teach others. So you say, all right, so you're going to start here with Paul, then you got Timothy, and then Timothy has somebody, and then that somebody has somebody. So you have this ongoing flow of students, not pupils, students. Why? Because we're supposed to make disciples, right? If we're supposed to make a disciple, that's a student. And that student has a reason for study. They have a call of God in their life. What is the call of God? I don't know, whatever it is. If we go through the book of Romans chapter 12 and we look at what we'll call the offices or the gifts in the church, you say, well, somebody must have, people must have one of these callings. Or you get over to 1 Corinthians 13 where he deals with it, or you get into other areas where Paul deals more briefly, and Jesus. You have these extensions in Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, and you say these are gifts to the church and through the church to the world. Really, this is a ministry. You say, well, how in the world am I going to gain the wisdom to know what that is? For instance, the gift of healing. Well, the gift of healing, Jennifer has the gift of healing. The gift of healing is not taking and put your hand on somebody and knocking them on a floor, and then they get up shouting. The gift of healing comes about through discipleship, which goes into the higher level of being a teacher, because you are studying the subject more deeply. So Jennifer's at the point where the people who know her have more confidence in her with regard to medicine and health than they do pretty much anybody else. What she's doing, what she did was she sought wisdom, and she's still seeking wisdom, and then God takes the wisdom, and something as simple as poking my finger to take blood out, to put the blood in the unit, to test the blood, to see what the number is, to know if my blood is too thin or too thick. So the other day, because she was sick, she had Diana come, and Diana got in, and Diana was. She had done it once before, but she was lost. So I had to call Jen on the phone. Got Jennifer on the phone. I said, this is, yep, just do this, okay. You're going to see. And then Diana did it successfully and passed the information on to Jennifer. So this is when he says, seek wisdom. If you lack wisdom, seek God or ask God, and God will give it to you. But it is not without the study part of it. So in this count it all joy, count it supreme joy, when you fall into different testings, I thought, let me just go through the Bible and take two or three guys in the Bible, and let's look at them. I'm going to start with Paul in 2 Corinthians 11, where Paul is basically giving his testimony. When we were at the Baptist church and I was youth director, I had a boy in that group who kept saying he wanted a ministry like Paul. And he'd get up and everybody would applaud and they were so happy that he wanted a ministry like Paul. And so I said to him one day, I said, have you ever looked at Paul's ministry life? What went on in it? And he said, well, no, but he was a great evangelist. I know, but there's another side to it. So here in the 11th chapter of 2 Corinthians, he starts off, these other guys have come along and they have boasted. This would be like a Copeland or Duplantis or those people coming along and really boasting. I mean, when you start boasting that God has to ask your opinion, that's pretty high level boasting. And these people are presenting themselves as something and then belittling Paul. So Paul starts in 22 and asks, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. These guys are no different. There's nothing that marks them out. What are we? We are saved by grace through Jesus Christ. So to start with, we stand on the same platform. And then he starts giving his testimony. He says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. Are they ministers of Christ? I am more than what these people are. In labors, more abundant. In stripes, which means he was getting beaten, above measure. In prison, more frequent. And in deaths, oft. Either actually dying, we think, as he did when he went to heaven, and had the view of heaven in which God sent him back, either that or the deaths of the beatings and so forth, bringing him close to death. So he said, this is my life, all right? So when James says, you're gonna fall into these trials, you go back and say, what kind of trials did these guys fall into? And keep in mind that in the place of the guys we're gonna mention, they all were basically in their life committed either to Yahweh in the Old Testament or to Christ in the New Testament. So he said he was more in labors, in stripes, above measure, in prison, more frequent, in deaths oft. Then he says, five times he received 39 stripes, 40 stripes save one. Now, 39 stripes were not little tiny touches on the body. 39 stripes were either, or could be both, with rods, so that they were swinging these rods and beating him on the back probably, or using some kind of whip or a mixture. But the belief was that if you hit him 40 times, you'll kill him, but 39 you won't. It's kind of like COVID can go 5 feet, 11 and 15, 16 inches, and it won't. It'll make you sick, but if it goes that last 16th of an inch, it won't, because so you stay 6 feet away from everybody. All right, so they said, 39, we'll go 39, but if we go to 40, then that we might kill him. So he said, five times that happened. Then he says, three times I was beaten with rods. So he had the stripes five times. Three times he was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. They threw the rocks at him to kill him, and they went away and left him. And then he said, three times I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day have I been in the deep, not on board a ship. The night and day he was in the deep, the ship was wrecked. So he was hanging on to something, floating in the water, until he was picked up by somebody. And that was for a night and a day he was in the deep. Then he says, in journeyings often, God sent me everywhere. You know, he had to go to Philippi, and he had to go to Ephesus, and he had to go to Thessalonica, and he had to go on and on and on. He had to go in the book of Acts. He talks about all these places. Paul said he was in journeyings often. Well, again, if we come back to the modern church, or what presents itself in the church, there's not much of that. Because a journeying can be physically, bodily, moving from place to place. But I see journeying also as the opportunity that some are using to go on something like Facebook. And if they put something on Facebook, I don't know how you determine, but if you put something on Facebook, it is going on to this internet program where I don't know how many people read what you're putting on there. I don't have any idea how that happens, if they have to sign up and become your friend or that sort of thing, or if you put it on public, what that means. But that's a form of journeying. And there's some stuff that people put on there that is really thought-provoking. So you look at it, it might be a simple little box like this with almost like a poetic thing, but there is depth to it. And when you read it, it makes you stop and think, and then they'll frequently put a question at the end as to whether you do this or whether you think this or whatever it might be. So I see these journeyings not just limited to going from place to place physically, but using whatever instrument God gives you to go from place to place in there. So I am not, there are people that know everything about it. I know very little. I go on Facebook once in a while. I put something on, and then I might get two or three responses, and a couple times I've gotten like 10 or 15 or 20 responses, people saying they liked what I put on, which doesn't really impress me. They can like it, but if they don't do anything with it, Betty has put some really powerful things on there that she got from somewhere. I don't think they were your own, right? You copied them. So anyway, he said journeyings. In perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of mine own countrymen. Well, what's happening in the United States? Who are you, if you're a Christian and you are professing Christ in truth, and therefore you are standing against satanic activity, you are going to be in danger from your own countrymen. And this is what's going on as Christians are being shut up, imprisoned, or whatever else is going on to try to keep God's word from reaching out in these journeyings. We don't want it. So in Facebook, I put a thing on Facebook. Don't ask me what it was. I don't remember now. I put something on Facebook, and the second day it was gone. They removed it. And they accused me what I put on there of provoking anger against somebody. That's my words. They have a different phrase that they use, you know, because this was going to, we'll say, sow discord. Yeah, of course, because it's the truth. So if you tell the truth, of course it's going to sow discord, because the enemy of the truth is not going to like it. And the people that are in his service are not going to like it. The only ones who are going to like it are the people who are in Christ's service. And then there, if there's something there that can help them, they're going to take it, and then they're going to go in the same way. And sometimes you get this thing where, again, I don't understand it, but it's a thing called share. And I think what that means is that if you hit that, whatever this is gets sent out to a broader field than what you, because you're going to share it with somebody. Well, that's, I see that also as going out and going into these, all the world, if you would, and preaching the gospel. So he was a night and day in the deep, in journeyings often, perils of waters and perils of robbers, perils of my own countrymen, perils by the heathen, perils in the city and perils in the wilderness and perils in the sea and perils among false brethren. So that's a heavy lifestyle. To be, he is the man chosen by God to be the apostle to the Gentiles. So here he is, sent by God. When it talks about John the Baptist in the first chapter of John, it says there was a man sent from God. Well, God's been sending men ever since creation, almost. God's been sending men. That's why he had Noah there. That's why he had Enoch there and so forth. God's been sending men, and God is still sending men. And in John's case, he was sent specifically to introduce Christ. So he prepared the way and then introduced him at the baptism. And now Christ gets on and John's service is over and he gets beheaded and he goes home to be with the Lord. So all of these things are a part of this service that you read of somebody else doing. Then when you look at your own problem in James, you begin to get some wisdom when he said, this is a trial of your faith, whether you have true faith or not. Then he said, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Now I've spent, I wouldn't say a whole lot of time, but a sizable amount of time thinking about the mark of the beast and the effect of it. And as we are seeing the various ideas, well, you have to have a COVID passport in order to buy anything. You can't get in the store without it. And in some parts of the world, it is to that point. And you say, well, wait a minute. Now, we're here. And if this comes up that you have to take the mark of the beast, whatever it is, and you, because of your faith in Jesus Christ, will not take the mark of the beast. And so they offer their threat. And they say, don't you know that if you don't do this, you're not going to be able to buy? You're not going to be able to sell. You're not going to be able to participate in commerce in any way. How are you going to feed your family? How are you going to feed yourself? How are you going to get health care? And we go through all of these things that we become accustomed to, and we say, how's that going to happen? Now, I only know one source to draw from when that question arises. And that is in the Lord's Prayer when he said, give us this day our daily bread. This is a legitimate request of God. Give us our daily bread. Now, it's up to God to determine what the bread is. Whatever it is, whatever this bread is, then there has to be a way of making it. But I also think in history, because of the circumstance that came up, there were many who died of starvation. There was no way. They couldn't get anything because they had a form of the mark of the beast at that particular point of history, and it had to do with their Christian faith. So I've thought about this a lot, and I've talked to God about it more with regard to my own life. What would I do if suddenly tomorrow somebody comes knocking on the door, and they say, I want to see your passport, I've thought about my response. Now, my response would probably include, because they did say, which they're trying to change, if you had a truly held religious belief. A truly held religious belief. One of the things they're doing is when they go and people say they won't take the shot because of the use of aborted babies in the preparation of this vaccine that they call it, which is not really a vaccine. And because that is, they cannot support it, therefore they can't take it. So that's followed with the question, have you taken any other vaccines? Have you taken any other? How does that mess around with your truly held religious belief? Now, what the Christian is going to have to do, I think, is they're going to have to refuse to answer those questions. And one of the instruments is what they call HIPAA laws. That they don't even have a right to ask you if you got the shot. They don't have a right to ask you those things if they are not given permission, and you're not giving permission. Now, whether that gets you anywhere or not, I don't expect it would necessarily, but that would be one of your defenses. But when you get to your truly held religious belief, and they say, well, what is your truly held religious belief? Well, I go through this with the state every year, and I don't do it in its entirety. I do it in a limited scope in which I say to them, the church is a religious ministry. And it has been assigned by God a certain responsibility. The state is a religious ministry and has been assigned by God a certain responsibility. And a part of that responsibility is not to give approval to everything you do. If you go in theory, they shouldn't be approving anything that's outside of whether you're inside of a law, which would be a law of God, or whether you're not inside of it. But then in my book, Soulworth, I have that one part where the preacher has been to a conference, and as he's driving home, he begins to think of all the things you have to do by state approval. And when he goes through the list, I don't know all the list that's there, but when he goes through this list, he comes to the reality that they've made the government a god. He said, man, we have to change this. We can't have government for God. We have to have God for God. And that provokes him into taking a different approach at the church and getting to the point of the law of God and not just saying, here's the law of God, but saying to the people, here's the law of God and you are required to keep it. You cannot do otherwise. So when I tell the state of Ohio, I go through this and I say, you're a religious ministry and we're a religious ministry. This is yours, this is ours. There's no place in the ministry, in what authority God gave you to go into the church. You can't take any part of the church. You can't determine who works in it. You can't determine who goes to it. You can't determine what is being taught. That's not, you don't have any authority there. That's within the bounds of the church. Now, if that's a truly held religious belief, I've been sending that letter to them now for years. And I just sent it out again the other day for this year. Now, I don't know what will happen. Last year, I got no response, and I simply attributed that to people working from home. And I thought, well, people working from home, you don't have the same kind of diligence as you do if they're in the office. So I sent this out again. I have to send it every September. And I sent it out, and I just do what we say, put it in the hands of God. And I actually added some things to it, and I had made a point, and this point is in the covenant also, and it's also in our Constitution, where I talk about, I think it's in the Constitution, where I talk about the school being an inseparable ministry of the church. It is a part of, it's inseparable. You can't separate the school from the ministry of the church, because it is the church. And that would be true of anything you're doing within the church. That's a ministry of the church. So I go on without going into all the detail. I conclude by saying to give any part of the ministry that God has given the church to the state would be the highest level of idolatry. And that we, in our truly held religious belief, cannot engage in idolatry. That would be a violation. Now, I don't know if they read it. I don't know if they take it and throw it in the wastebasket, if they just look at the name and address and say, he did it. But what I'm doing is I am trying to tell them we have a truly held religious belief. And our truly held religious belief, as I've told the kids in school now a couple of times in the last week or so, I was talking about the fact that Candace and Nicole and Billy and Hannah are church members. They are what's called a communicant member. They're a member of the church. And I was going through saying, what's the difference between an attendee at the church and a member of the church? And the answer in simplicity is government. You don't have the same position of authority with somebody who just attends as you do with somebody who's a member. So if you have a truly held religious belief, you have to make that distinction. And you have to say, if a person is a member, what do they do to become a member? They have to agree to the positions taken by the church in its book of order, constitution, whatever you want to say. So when you read through it, you read this and this and this, and then you, as you're reading it, you're saying, is that my position? If that's your position, then you agree to it, and you become a member. There are people who agree to the position, but for some reason they don't want to be a member. That's between them and God. I don't have an answer for that. So in my dealing with a state, I am subjecting myself, I'm opening myself up to response, to retaliation. It's getting worse as it goes along. It's not just in the state either. It's in church organizations and churches who have heard me do this presentation who got very angry. And the reason they're angry, oddly enough, is they're afraid that by us taking a truly held religious belief, that's going to come back on their heads. I don't know how. I suppose if the state came in and said, here's what Shekinah Church is saying, is this your position as well? And that church said no, then the state would say, well, what do you have as a truly held religious belief? And part of it they're doing now is when people say, I can't take the vaccine, they say, have you taken anything else? So what they're going to have to learn to do is say, it's none of your business. You're violating HIPAA laws to ask me that question, to ask me if I have, you don't have the authority to do it. Now, if you do, it's probably going to be a price. What the price is, I don't know, but this goes into this when you fall into the different kinds of testings. So Paul goes through this list, and then when he finishes, he said on verse 28, that on top of all the things he listed, besides those things are without, that which comes upon me daily, the care of all the churches. Well, there is a care of the church. On our bulletin every week, on the back of the bulletin, there is what I would call a summation. And so caring for the church is the attempt to stay pure in what you say you believe, making sure you actually do it. So that's Paul said, I have the care of the churches. And I don't know how many churches, but he obviously had a bunch. Then he asks, who is weak and I am not weak, who is offended and I burn not? If I must needs glory, I will glory of the things which concern my infirmities. Now, very briefly, because I've taken so much time on Paul, I want to go back to the book of Genesis and talk about Joseph just for a minute, okay? Joseph, Genesis chapter 39. Now, Joseph has been charged, as you know, with a false charge. He has been accused of trying to rape the wife of Potiphar. He didn't do it. She made the whole thing up, but apparently she was held in high regard, and so the people, without searching, come and arrest Joseph. And it says in 19 of verse 39, it came to pass when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, after this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. The guy, Potiphar, gets angry. He doesn't have the true story, but he gets angry. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph. Now, there's the key. I think as we go through this, this is one of the things you have to keep balancing with. The Lord is with. The Lord is with. So the Lord was with Paul. The Lord is with us. The Lord is with the church. I don't care where it is in the world. When it is a true church, the Lord is with us. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in sight of the keeper of the prison. So he goes in there under a real bitter sentence of hatred. But when he's in there, God gives him favor. And it says, the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatever they did, he was the doer of it. So now he goes from this accusation, which costs him an arrest. I don't know whether there's a trial other than the accusation, being cast into prison, And that's one of those trials. And so Joseph goes into this, and it says the keeper of the prison, because of Joseph's life, because of his constantly expressing his, what we call, truly held religious beliefs, the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand. If Joseph was doing it, the keeper was not checking it out, because he knew that Joseph was right, and he said, because the Lord was with him. And that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. So in 2021, we have to kind of come to a position. We're not in prison, although there are people in prison for their faith. There are people suffering for their faith, and we could be in prison. The issue will not be where we are. The issue will be who's with us. So he said the Lord was with him. So Joseph begins to get exalted, and of course he finally interprets some dreams for Pharaoh and ends up being second in command in Egypt because he was just faithful to the Lord, and the Lord was with him. So this is our privilege, if you would. It's a privilege to have the Lord be with us that the world can't say. The world cannot give you anything about the Lord being with them. In fact, the Lord is against them. Well, I've kind of gone overboard here.